Okay, so last week was a pretty happy week. We gotta enjoy the happy weeks while they last, because next week might be happy with Arya Crown, but it's not gonna be happy for Arshir, because next week we're gonna start to get into David and Bathsheba. At the end, it'll be happy maybe, but it's gonna be a long road to get there. But last week was the wonderful, wonderful chesed of David with Mephibosheth, where we saw David's devotion to chesed, and after trying and trying and trying to find to you know, bring the houses of Shaul and David together. The dream that David had, the dream that Yehonasan had, and it failed with Shaul, and it failed with Yehonasan, and it failed with Ish-bosheth, and it failed with Avner, and it failed with Michal. But you don't give up, and one last burst of chesed, and finally the Navi says that we pulled it off with Mephibosheth living in Yerushalayim, eating like one of David's own sons in David's house. So what we're going to see this week is, it's going to be David's chesed part two. This week the chesed is going to be a little bit more questionable. We're going to see two basic ways of understanding what David does this week. One way is that it's yet another week of amazing chesed, where David tries to reconnect with an old enemy. Another way of seeing it, though, is maybe David is going a little bit too far in the chesed department, and all of this is going to be setting up what's coming around next week, which is going to be the sin of Bathsheba and Uriah, which we're going to have to really dig into. So let's let me find this worksheet, and then we can screen share it. Okay. All right, here we go. All right, so if you remember last week, we saw that one of the amazing ways that the Navi communicated the human element of David's chesed was how the Navi shifted from calling David the Melech to calling David, David. Remember, the parak last week really had three parts. There was David's first conversation with Tziva, the former Eved of Shaul, who mysteriously got fantastically rich. During that conversation, David was referred to again and again as the Melech. At the end of the parak, there was David's second conversation with Tziva, where he orders him to serve Mephibosheth. Once again over there, David was the Melech. But those three psukim where David and Mephibosheth are talking face-to-face, the names were brought front and center. Mephibosheth's name was introduced, and David is called David again and again and again. Despite all the history that they had, and despite all the trappings of power that David enjoys now, at the end of the day, he was still the same David, the same humble man of chesed that he was when he first burst onto the scene as the shepherd who cared for every individual sheep. We begin Parak Yud, and it seems like these two prakim are next to each other, because as we said last week, historically speaking, the reconciliation of David and Mephibosheth happened very early, at the very beginning of his reign in Yerushalayim. Now we're fast-forwarding a whole bunch of years. But we see the same exact behavior from David. But the Navi tells us that the king of Ammon died and his son Hanun takes over. Now, it doesn't tell us in the first pasuk who the king was. It just tells us the king of Ammon. But David, right? You see, David breaks out the names. Vayomer David, Esa chesed im Hanun ben Nachash. Let me do chesed for Hanun, the son of Nachash. So apparently Nachash was the previous king. Kasher saw Vivi Madichas and his father did chesed with me. Let's talk about what that is. So David sends like a Nicham Avelim chesed delegation. David's servants come to the land of Ammon. Three times in one pasuk we see David, David, David. Right? We see the name of the person he's trying to connect to. We're bringing back the same chesed playbook from the previous parak, and we're using the same language of chesed. Now, this is really astounding when we consider who this person Nachash was, because Nachash has a history with Bnei Yisrael, to put it mildly, and it's not a pretty one. In Shmuel Aleph, Parak Yud Aleph, at the very beginning of Shaul's reign, when Shaul was first crowned king, wasn't even accepted by the people yet, so Nachash, at the time, the king of Ammon, attacked Yavesh Gilad, which is, a Jewish settlement on the other side of the Jordan River. And he basically has them surrounded. They have no hope. They offer to surrender. And Nachash told them something unbelievably, I mean, barbaric, frankly. He said, Echros lachem, I'll make a covenant with you. Bin kor lachem kol ein yamin. If every single member of the city takes out their right eye, right? Like, this is pretty nasty stuff. So Nachash was a hardened enemy of Bnei Yisrael. What launches Shaul on his career is the fact that he's able to unite Bnei Yisrael in pushing back against Yavish Gilad. Not for now, but everything that Shaul does in that parak is a total undoing of all of the sins of the Pilegesh Begiva episode at the end of Sefer Shoftim. But Nachash seems like he's the total scum of the earth. So it's pretty surprising that he did chesed for David. But David now sees an opportunity to maybe rebuild some of those connections. Now, what was the chesed that Nachash possibly did? So Rashi, Radak, all the Mefarshim explain. I think we talked about this the other week, right? That Nachash protected the one fugitive brother that David had who escaped from Moab when the king of Moab massacres all of David's family, right? So Nachash does some personal favor for David. Does he do that because he's a nice guy? Probably not, because he's obviously not a nice guy. He's probably doing it because he understands, he's politically savvy. He knows that David is the enemy of Shaul, so the enemy of my enemy can be my friend. Just like over by the Plishtim, you have Achish, the king of the city of Gat, who sees David as a useful tool. So Nachash might have the same realpolitik perspective, but it doesn't matter what it was. David says, at the end of the day, his father did chesed for me. We're going to let bygones be bygones, and let's try to reconnect with the new generation. We have a new administration. Maybe all of the difficult history between Bnei Yisrael and Ammon can be overcome. And if we think about it, we can see that this is David's playbook once again, right? Last week was David trying to reconcile with the house of Shaul, where there was a whole lot of history, but let's get water under the bridge. And you sprinkle some chesed on it, and there's always hope for peace and reconciliation. And the same exact thing is going to happen now. Okay, the previous king of Bnei Yisrael, the previous king of Ammon, things didn't go very well. But new chance, new opportunity. Let's show some chesed and let's see what's going to happen. Now, we'll have to talk in a minute about whether it sounds impressive, what David's instinct over here. We'll see a basic breakdown in the Mefarshim whether that's the case or not. But however however laudable the attempt was, David meets far less success in this reconciliation effort with Ammon than he met 1 week ago with Mephibosheth. Because the Navi tells us that the princes of Ammon, Tel Hanun, come on, you think that David is really sending you a chesed delegation? Halabavur ha'kora'ir. David is extremely sly and savvy. He's sending spies to the city. Okay, so Hanun does something surprising because we know what usually happens to spies. Spies are supposed to be executed. When Yehoshua sends spies to Jericho, Jericho finds out about it. They want to kill the spies. The Ramban talks about the nace that the Meraglim were not harmed when they were traveling up and down Eretz Yisrael. The penalty for spying is death. And yet that's not what Hanun does. What Hanun does is he shaves off half of their beards. He splits their clothes halfway down, ad shisoseim, until the area where their legs split, vayishalchein, and he sends them away. So you have this idea of splitting like three different times, right? We have David is trying to bring everybody together, and then Hanun is splitting, splitting, splitting. He's cutting off half the beard. He's splitting their pants, and he's splitting their pants until the area where the legs divide, right? The attempt at unity and the response of total division. Now, why on earth would he do that? So Abarbanel makes a suggestion. I want to modify it a little bit. And basically, Batman fans, right? So one of the villains is Two-Face, right? Who half his face looks beautiful and half his face looks totally hideous and scarred. So that's basically exactly what the message that Hanun is sending over here. You're being two-faced with me, David. On the one hand, you're sending me a very impressive and beautiful chesed. On the other hand, it's all a subterfuge for an attempt to spy out my capital city and my kingdom. So what am I going to do in response? I'm going to send back your diplomats, half looking very elegant and impressive with beautiful clothing and a handsome beard, and half naked and shaved. Okay, so it's a message to David. It's a humiliation. And rule number one with David, who has a temper, as we have seen and will continue to see, is don't get David angry. So Hanun violates the rule. He gets David angry. So David is told what happened. The people were extremely embarrassed. David is furious about this. David, the man of sensitivity, you can imagine how he feels. He sent this delegation on a peace mission. It's, now they're coming back totally embarrassed and humiliated. They have to walk naked through the streets, and they're totally clean shaven. The Radak points out, everybody in Bnei Yisrael at the time had beards. The Radak actually says, not like nowadays. You see, nowadays, you walk through the streets of medieval Spain, you'll see plenty of people clean shaven. You can imagine a world where everyone has a beard. You know, you're the only clean shaven guy. It's terrible. You know, like if you've ever had... I guess COVID could be an analogy. If you ever run a situation where you're in a place where you're supposed to wear a mask and you realize, oh, I forgot to put it on, I don't have my coat, and look around and everyone else has one, it's like, you know, that's a little uncomfortable. So this, just socially, let alone set aside anything else. This, kal v'chomer, the only clean-shaven people in the entire country. So what does David tell them to do? But you remember Melech, he's now king, he's no longer David the man of Chesed. But you remember Melech, shivu b'recho adi tamach zikam chan b'shach. David says, wait in Yericho. Yericho is the very first city on the Jewish side of the Jordan River. Wait there until your beards grow back. The Dat Mikra points out that Yericho right now is still in ruins because Yehoshua passed a curse on anybody who would rebuild it. It hasn't been rebuilt yet. So as a totally isolated settlement, there's nobody there, and they can regain some of their dignity. Right? It's pretty impressive sensitivity that David has to his own men. He understands their humiliation. He says, why don't you wait in the protected bubble of Yericho until the beards go back, and then you're going to then you can return to Jerusalem. But you know, David's attempt at peace over here goes, you know, the total opposite of his attempt last week, right? The reconciliation with Mephibosheth was fantastic. The reconciliation with Amon is a total disaster. And so we need to ask, was David in the right here, or was he in the wrong? There's no doubt, I think, that the pshat is that once again we see a lot of, you know, David is looking impressive over here. Right? I mean, what's wrong with chesed? Well, what might be wrong with chesed, and this is heatedly debated over here, the Radak quotes the Medrash, which is in a couple of different places. Torah tells us in Sefer Devarim, have it right here on the source sheet. Lo yavo amoni moavi b'kal Hashem. Right, somebody from Amon or Moav cannot enter into the assembly of God. We know, right? Amoni u'moavi, only the males, not the females. That has personal resonance for David because his great grandmother is Rus Hamoavia. But gam dorasi lo yavo lehem b'kal Hashem ad olam. Why not? Al davar shelo kinu eschem b'lachem u'b'mayim b'dara. Right, because Amon and Moav, they totally abandoned the legacy of Chesed. They totally abandoned the legacy of Avram Avinu. They wouldn't give us food. They wouldn't give us water. We were coming out of Egypt. They hired Bilam against us, right? They completed the betrayal that Lot began. Lot began the betrayal of Abraham, but he tried to at least hold on to the values of Achnasas Orchim, but his descendants, the Ammon and Moab, completely repudiate the bond. And since they repudiate the bond, it can't come back. They can never come back into the Kaal Hashem Ad Olam. And the Torah concludes, Lo Sidro Shalom Tavasam Kol Yamecha Le'olam. You cannot seek out their peace or their good for all of your days. You cannot attempt to make peace with Amon and Moab. They have gone too far. They have broken the bond, and we're not bringing it back. So now, wait a second. As lovely and wonderful as it is that David is trying to effect a reconciliation with Hanun, and let's forget about Nachash and that war and the attempt at mutilation. Amon seems to have a thing for like half mutilating Jews. It's like pretty disturbing. So as nice as it may sound, well, maybe it's inappropriate. So the Medrash says, yeah, Loti Joshlama Tovasam, Atamotse Bemisha Baalehem, Midas Rachamim, Sof Balide Bizayon. You see, someone who tries to come to these people from Ammon, and he tries to be a bleeding heart do-gooder with mercy, the end is just going to lead to disgrace. Right? And that, the Medrash says, is exactly what happens to David over here. Medrash concludes this Radak quotes, Amar Lo Kadosh Baruch Hu David, Ata Over Al Torasi, you're violating my Torah. Anika Safti Lo Sejo Shalom Atovasam, I said, do not seek out their peace and their good. You thought it was a good thing to do. Ata Oseimam Chesed. Well, what do we say to David? Al Tehi Tzadik Harbe, do not be excessively righteous. Okay? So David doesn't know that pasuk yet because his son is going to write it. It's a line in Koheles. But don't be excessively righteous. Mikan shelo yehei adam mevater al ha-Torah. Person should not say, you know, I'm not going to hold to this thing, the Torah. I think this is wrong. I think this is immoral. How could it be that the halacha legislates that I can't make peace with Ammon and Moab? We love peace. Derecha derechi Noam. You know, Eitz Chaim hi, Torah shalom. Why can't we make peace? I'll make peace. My moral intuition is better than the moral intuition of Dvarim Perachav Gimel, Pasuk Zayin. Medrash says to David, you've taken the chesed too far. Now, this approach, right, this understanding of David, that last week's chesed was fantastic, but this week's chesed is too far. Well, we've seen this movie before about somebody who Chazal call out for showing excessive chesed in an area when the Torah told them not to do it. Right? And that is, of course, Shaul with Amalek, where Chazal had the exact same approach classically. You, Shaul, decided, I don't care what the Torah says about wiping out Amalek, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to spare Agag. Right? I'm going to have mercy on Agag. That's very nice and lovely and beautiful. Well, Al Tzadik Harbe. Because what's the conclusion? What do Chazal say? Somebody who violates that part of the Pasuk in Koheles of being excessively righteous will end up violating the other half of the Pasuk of Koheles of not being excessively wicked, right? Chazal say, once Shaul goes off the range, he decides to follow his own moral intuition about when to be merciful. Well, that same Shaul who has mercy on Agag, the king of Amalek, a murderer, is going to end up killing the Kohanim of Noah, right? Once you leave the subordination to the Torah's moral system, you're just going to end up in disaster. Well, Chazal saying this over here by David makes us realize that they're pointing us to the exact same trajectory, right? In this read of our parak, David's excessive chesed here is setting up what? It is setting up his own excessive wickedness in the next parak, right? David, you have excessive mercy on Ammon. We're going to end up having adultery and murder one parak late, right? So what this Medrash is doing here that the Radak is bringing is showing us that we're planting the seeds, and they seem like very innocuous seeds, but the excessive chesed here is planting the seeds of the sins that are coming down the road. Last week's chesed was fantastic, but this week's chesed is going too far, and the ultimate spiritual consequences are going to be devastating. Okay. Now, there is, though, another way to look at this whole parak, because the pshat in the psukim is that David seems phenomenal. There's no hint in the psukim per se that is critical of David for offering peace to Ammon. It doesn't work out, but there's no sense from the psukim themselves that what he did was wrong. When Shaul spares Agag, that was obviously incorrect, right? Shmuel blasts him for it. But where is the hint in the psukim per se that what David did was wrong in offering peace to the people from Ammon? The truth is, Rashi pretty clearly did not read the psukim here as being critical of David, because the way where Rashi brings the line from not making peace with Ammon, Rashi actually understands that that was the line of the king of Ammon, right, of Hanun's advisors. When they say to him, Amachabe David, you think that David is sending you a nice peace delegation, they said, come on, hey, Muzharim lo tidrosh shalom. All of a sudden, the people of Ammon are Bible scholars. Their Torah, their Bible says to them not to seek out your peace. Who Yodrosh Shlomcha, he's going to seek your peace. Nah, David's lying, it's all a front. So the way Rashi's understanding it, David had genuine and beautiful intentions, right? It was Amon's misunderstanding that led to the disaster. But why would David actually be allowed to send a genuine peace delegation? Why would the advisors of Amon be wrong? Why wouldn't Lo Tidrosh Shalomam apply over here? Well, the answer basically comes from the Rambam and then from the Haggadah Mamuniot. Right? The Haggadah Mamuniot is a commentary on the Rambam, very similar to the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch. Right? The Rav Yosef Karo writes the Shulchan Aruch, so the Ramah writes literally in the margins of the Shulchan Aruch all of his glosses about what the Ashkenazi Psak is. So a couple of hundred years earlier, the same exact thing happens with the Rambam. The Rambam is Sephardi, obviously. And when the Mishnah Torah gets to Ashkenaz, so one of the students of Maharami Rundberg writes the Hagahot Maimonios, right? The glosses on the Rambam, giving rulings from Ashkenaz, which you know are relevant to what the Rambam is talking about. So the Rambam tells us in Hilchos Malachim U'Malchim, that's the Perek Vav. So he begins the Perek actually with a controversial ruling. The Rambam says that we need to send a peace delegation before we make any war. Any war that Jews ever make, first there needs to be a peace offering sent out first. What's controversial is that includes Amalek, and that includes the seven nations of Canaan, right? There are rules and regulations they have to follow if they're going to submit to the Shev Mitzvos B'nei Noach, but the Rambam thinks that we always first send out a peace offering before we make war. The Ravid is not very happy about that. But then in Halacha Vav, the Rambam tells us, there's one exception, and the exception is Amun Amav. Amun Amav ain shochel hem shalom. You do not send them a peace delegation before you go to war. Next, Torah tells us, lo tidro shalom tovasam kol yamecha. Now, what gets complicated, though, is that the Rambam says at the end of the halacha, afal pisha in shalom v'shalomam, we do not send a peace delegation to Amun Amav. However, im hishlimu me'atzmam t'chila, if they offer peace to us, mikavlenosan, we'll accept them. There's always a potential for tshuva, and Amun Amav may have burned the bridges sufficiently that we are no longer allowed to reach out to them. But if they reach out to us, writes the Rambam, the Torah never prohibited that. Right? You read the psukim literally. Lo tidro shalom. Do not seek out their peace. However, if they seek out yours, then you're not seeking peace anymore. You're only reciprocating. Writes the Haggadah Mamuniot right there on the bottom of the page. So he quotes the Re'im, Rabbi Lazar Mimitz, who writes the Sefer Yireim. He's a Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam. So he writes a book on all the 613 mitzvos, which is absolutely fascinating. So the Yireim on this mitzvah of not, you know, seeking out the peace of Amun Moav. So what does he give as an example? He says, you can't seek them out, right? Drisha shalom, aval tashlume shalom, responding with peace, mutter, that's totally fine. Kigon im asu im chachased, if they did something nice for you, mutter lefakdam l'shalom, so you can remember them for peace. Shnei Amar, what's his proof? Vayamas melech b'nei Amon, vayamal chanun b'nei tachta, vayamar David, asa chased im chanun, kasher asa avi imadi chased, right? So Haggadah Simonio says, all David is doing is showing reciprocal chesed. Reciprocal chesed, that's fine, right? That's totally acceptable. So that's then another way of looking at this. Now, the Or Sameach and the Malbim try to square the Medrash with this halacha. So the Malbim, the Or Sameach, for example, says, okay, well, you can do chesed, but David was entitled to do chesed with the father, right, Nachash, who says he can do chesed with the son. The Malbim, you know, this is a little bit more politically insightful. The Malbim says the chesed that Amon showed to David was as a private citizen, but David is showing chesed as the king, and he's sending a formal national diplomatic delegation. So it's not, right, David is advancing the chesed. He is not strictly responding in kind, right? he's taking things up a notch. You know, you spared my brother. I will offer a formal peace treaty. So one could wonder whether or not that would still be included in the prohibition halachically. We're getting into kind of a gray zone. But if you go with the Hagos Maimonides, so we say that there is just a different way of looking at what David is doing over here. David is actually doing fantastic chesed, right? He remembers what happened long ago. We could speculate politically that why does David only wait until now? Why not send the chesed delegation to Nachash himself? Probably because there's no way, after everything that Nachash did, that David could politically offer a peace with the king of Ammon, who tried to mutilate the people of the whole city of Israel. But there's a son, and there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity to build, is the father did something, but David couldn't run with it. Now we can use that to run with the son. So the other way to look at this whole parak is that David tries once again, right? He's committed to reconciliation, and it's beautiful and wonderful. And we see David's hyper chesed, and all that's going to do for next week is going to be set up the total and stunning reverse. And then we'll have to wonder, how could the man of such extraordinary chesed last week with Mephibosheth, despite everything that happened with Shaul, and this week with Chanun, despite everything that happened with Nachash, and we say it's all wonderful, then we're going to have to ask, how on earth could the man of chesed do things which seem so cruel next week, right? Either way that we look at the psukim now, that David is being too kind, and that's planting the seeds for next week, or he's being amazingly kind, and we need to wonder how on earth could next week happen, right? Those are the two main ways to read what's happening here in the parable. So, it then continues, and we're trying to focus on David here. So we're not going to spend so much time in the middle part of the parak, but we need to look at it a little bit because it's just one of the most stirring and inspiring lines that anybody says ever in Tanakh. We won't get into the military details of it all, but David sends Yoav and the Tzva Giborim, right? He sends the professional army to go attack. Now they're going to get more than they bargained for because they're not only going to fight against Ammon, but Ammon realizes that they're in trouble. Ammon is a pretty small country. So Ammon hires all of the various Aramean states. There are a whole bunch of city states in Aram, and Ammon hires four of them. Now that's another brotherly betrayal, by the way, because Ammon is supposed to be our brother from Lot, and Aram is supposed to be our brother from Lavan, but they're all betraying that. They're all going to war against us. David sends Yoav over there. Yoav realizes he's in trouble. He's surrounded. He's fighting against two different armies. What is he going to do? So Yoav splits his forces. He takes the better troops to go fight against Aram, and he takes the weaker troops. He gives them to his brother Avishai, and he says, basically, you just stay here and face Ammon. The Malbim explains that Yoav, it was really a brilliant military insight, that Yoav realizes that Ammon, even though they have their army there, they don't actually want to attack. Ammon is happy to just stay with the protection of their fortified capital city. So Yoav, the only way Yoav can get in trouble is if Aram comes to where he is, right? He can't fight both armies together, but he realizes Ammon really wants to stay put. So he'll go off to fight Aram, and his brother Avishai will stay camped against the city, and Ammon is not going to come out to attack. Ammon will stay on the defensive, and that's going to give him the breathing space he needs to go handle Aram and then come back to help his brother Avishai. It's a moment of real, it's a moment of courage. It's a moment of loyalty. Two brothers who are working together at a time where everything else is being split. The beards are being split and the pants are being split, and David's attempt at Shalom is being split, and the brotherhood of Ammon is finally torn apart, and the brotherhood of Aram is torn apart. Avishai and Yoav stick together. Those are brothers who are fighting as one, and it's beautiful and it's amazing. And Yoav has a very famous line in Pasuk Yud-Beis, where he says, Chazak v'nitz chazek bi'ara menu, we're going to strengthen ourselves for our nation, uva'ara rei elokeinu, for the cities of our God. It's not just any cities. These are cities in Eretz Yisrael. It's Eretz HaKodesh that we're fighting for. V'ashem yasa tov be'inav, and Hashem will ultimately do what he thinks is good. The Rabbag says about this pasuk from Yoav, this is the paradigm for how we are supposed to approach the quintessential question of human effort versus divine providence, right? Hishtadlus versus Hashkacha. Rabbag says, you see, we put in our maximum effort, Chazak v'nes Chazak b'yadam min avad arei elokeinu, and at the same time recognize Hashem yasa tovinav. Ultimately, we recognize that the final decision for success or failure will depend on the Ribbono Shel Olam. But we have to daven, but that doesn't excuse us from not doing our part, right? Ein l'smoch al hanes, avar ro'oi she'yishtadel ha'adam be'etzalaso l'fi ma she'efshar. He has to try as hard as he can. The az yezor Hashem yisporah. And then he can hope for divine assistance. So Yoav and Avishai, the Jewish generals, are absolutely incredible and amazing. And it's really Yoav's finest hour. We see here why he was really the greatest, either the greatest or the second greatest Jewish general of all time. Okay, he and Yehoshua can compete over who's the better general. But as we're trying to keep the focus on David, so the battle is a total and complete smashing success. Yoav chases away Aram. Yoav comes back to relieve his brother. The whole army is able to escape unscathed. They go back to Yerushalayim. And now, what happens next? So the Navi tells us, Aram kinigath lefnei Yisrael v'yas v'yacha. So Aram realizes that they have retreated. The last battle did not go as planned. So they unite, right? We have these themes in the parak of uniting versus dividing. So they try to unite. The king of the leading group from Aram, Aram Tzova, so he sends his general, Shovach, Saratzva Hadadezer. So we have the Jewish general is Yoav. We have the Aramean general is Shovach. Now what happens? The climax of the Perek is after Yoav, David sends Yoav with his army, and then Yoav splits his army. There was the Aramean army and the Ammon army, which were divided. We had Hadadezer sending his general, right? With many, many, many examples again and again in the Parak, doing this quickly, but many examples of the Parak, every army is being split or it's being sent. The king is sending his generals. The generals are splitting their forces. The climax is combating all of that right here, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayugad leDavid vayasof es kol Yisrael, right? David himself gathers all of Israel together. The first battle when he sent Yoav, Yoav only had the Tzva HaGiborim. He only had the professional troops. This time, any Jewish male between 20 and 60, you're joining David on, it's a united war effort. Vayavor es haYarden, vayavo Chaylama. David crosses over the Jordan River. He fights against Aram in Chaylama, which is like, I think that Mikra says it's like a little bit south and east of the Yam HaKinaret. And what happens? It's a total success. Shovach is killed. The troops are routed. It's unbelievable. And the last pasuk over here, all of the allies of Hadadezer realized that they were defeated. So they changed sides. Instead of being vassals to Hadadezer, they become vassals to David. And Aram is too afraid to help Ammon anymore. So all of the various and sundry alliances where the Arameans and the Ammonim were all uniting in a coalition against us, they fall out, they betray each other. In the first battle, Ammon does not attack, they leave Aram isolated. Now Aram betrays Ammon, they will not fight Bnei Yisrael anymore. Hadadezer's own allies betray him, right? On the other side, it all ends in total collapse and failure and betrayal and isolation. And we shouldn't be surprised, because nations like that who would betray the original commitments to Bnei Yisrael, it's not surprising they break out with each other as well, right? Lot is supposed to be our brother. Our Lavan is supposed to be our brother. And they went back on it to us. It shouldn't be surprising they go back on it to themselves. And that is all being contrasted with the unity of Yoav and Avishai. And then finally, the unity of Bnei Yisrael under David, who does not send some general this time, But in the climactic victory, it's the other side, right? Hadadezer is sending his general Shobach. David says, that's not what a Jewish king does. This time, I'm going to go by myself at the head of all the troops. We're going to go together as one united Am Yisrael. And it ends up as a fantastic, fantastic victory, right? Now, all that does now, you know, let's come around to how does this set up the beginning of next week, right? The beginning of David and Bathsheba, because we get to the first two psukim of the next week, and everything we're building up now about the unity that B'nai Yisrael have, and the king at the head of the united army, well, all that sets up a pivotal diuk that the Malbim is going to have at the beginning of the next pack. What does the Nabi tell us afterwards? So this battle concluded with Aram defeated, right? We have Ammon in the south. We have Aram in the north. So Aram was the bigger power. They've been totally broken up and divided, and that was a success. Ammon has still been left relatively unscathed, right? In the first battle of Yoav and Avishai, Avishai just fought a defensive holding battle. He didn't attack Ammon. They were just bottled up by their capital city. Then after Yoav won his battle, they were all able to retreat. Then they went up to the north to fight Ammon. Now they're coming back down to the south to fight Ammon. So the Nabi tells us, the next year, time when kings go out to battle, it's a new campaign season. The rainy season is over. The roads aren't wet anymore. You can actually travel. It's not too hot, but it's not too wet. So it's time to go fight. What happens? By Yishlach David es Yav es Avadavimo ves Kol Yisrael. So David sends the whole united army. Vayashchisu es Bnei Ammon. Right, they defeat the people of Ammon. Vayatzu al Rabah, they besiege the city. But David yoshev Yerushalayim. But David remains in Yerushalayim. The Malbim says this is going to be David's original sin. That after everything we built up this week, right, with all of the chesed that David had, and then finally the united, and him at the head of the army, but now for some reason there is a relapse. David, after all of the years of fighting and after that phenomenal success, right? You know, somebody think about it. Think of running a marathon. You know, somebody runs a marathon, they run for 26.2 miles. And it's like an endless race, right? The minute that they get to the finish line, they collapse, right? And it's like you ask, can you run another half mile? You go to somebody who finished the marathon and say, can you run another half mile? You just did 26.2 miles. You know, can you do another half mile? They're not going anywhere, right? They are done. You ever seen like the marathon ends and they're all like wrapped up in their aluminum foil blanket and they're, you know, ready to go out to dinner. They can't go any further. David has fought for years, basically since he was a kid. I mean, he was with Goliath, and then he was Shaul's general, and then he was a fugitive, and then he was fighting with the Plishtim, and he was fighting with Ishbosheth, and he was fighting all the other enemies. We have this climactic success, and David reaches a point of exhaustion. He stays home. But it is that lack of stamina, right, at that key moment where just everything falls apart. David's taking a nap. Says the Malbim, what on earth is doing David taking a nap? Anytime in Tanakh that a king takes a nap, it doesn't end well. Last king we saw taking a nap was Ishbosheth. His nap ended with him getting killed. Jewish kings are supposed to be busy. You have a nation to take care of. You're either in the field fighting the wars, or you're in the Bezdin making sure that there's tzedek and mishpat, that it's a just society. Malbim points out, David's not doing either one. He could be at home. Okay, he wants to be at home because the Chazal had said from a couple of prakim ago that the ideal situation was Yoav is in the field with the army, and David is pursuing Tzedek and Mishpat. That'll be one thing. David is exhausted, and David asks for a vacation. We can understand that. David's more entitled to a vacation than any of us ever were. But when you're at David's level and you have David's responsibility, everything that's happening in this parak sets up the failure which is coming next. And what happens when he takes the break, and he's on the vacation, and he's on the roof, and he had the nap, all of a sudden, Beis Halacha, Gag Beis HaMelech, he's chilling out on the roof of the palace. Vayari Sharach Chatzos Melech Gag, Beishat Tovas Marema Od. And it's all downhill from there, right? So we'll still need to understand, if we have David being, you know, a real loyal acolyte of Chesed, we'll have to wonder how do we have the transition. But it's important for us to appreciate that while the Navi is driving home the phenomenal success that we have over a year, right? It's also setting up that David's exhausted, and that exhaustion is going to come back to bite him. So we have a parak which is a beautiful parak of unity. Bnei Yisrael are united. David, you know, the brothers are united. The people are united. David's united. The army is united. The different parts of the army are working together, and it's in stark contrast with everyone else. David tried to reconcile with Mephibosheth. He's trying to reconcile over here, right? I think one more message maybe that the parak may have for us is it's about to get into some very dark times. So maybe there's a very simple message in this parak, which is let's keep in mind the greatness that David has on display. Setting aside the questions of how can whatever happened next week happen, let's nail down in our memories the chesed and the energy and the dedication and the bitachon of David HaMelech. So that whatever comes next week, the Navi wants us to know, approach next week with the realization that we are talking about a king who is the greatest of the great. Right. And with equipped with that realization, equipped with knowing everything that's been accomplished until now, that this is the king who has done chesed efforts that nobody would ever do. He has shown a human sensitivity that nobody would have to his own diplomats, to the sons of the people who tried to kill him, to the historical enemies of his people. This is the person, this is the man of the chesed that we're dealing with. And we get to next week, and we'll see the Navi be unbelievably harsh with David, you know, to put it mildly, but it's like, you know, just a little bit of like sunscreen to put on before we get into there to remember who it is that we're dealing with. Okay, so there's a thought left to hear, but otherwise we'll wrap it up and we'll come back next week. Yeah.
Oh, just one quick question. Back to the beginning of the parak, could it be that specifically Yericho is where David recommends that they rest because to grow back, because Yericho epitomizes everything we're talking about, meaning the unity of Bnei Israel, the reason that we can't rebuild Yericho is because it's not a random city. So maybe, meaning, is it like overthinking it to say that's why they should dafka go there?
It could be a little bit in the terms of like Yericho just geographically makes a lot of sense for them to go because it is the first place right out, and that's why, right, it's the first city when you cross the Jordan River. But you could totally speculate. You can totally speculate. No, I mean, the other greatest conqueror is Yoshua. No, right, exactly. Yoshua's conquests are like totally, everyone is together. Like, you know, it's like all beautiful. So.
Right, right. Or then conversely, when Chiel tries to rebuild Yericho, it's sort of the beginning of not the beginning of the end, but meaning in the middle of the end and the.
Yeah, no, it is. It is the beginning of the end. Ominous time. He does it at the point where the 10 tribes or the kingdom of Ahav is at its climax, and it's
right. Totally right. So, okay. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. Yashar Koach, everybody. Okay. Have a great week. Looking forward to next time.
Thank you.
Take care.